great. Okay. This is going to be a little different from what Paul is doing, what Dr. Felix is doing. And this is Eagle Fern Family Camp. I just put together this presentation last night, and I cannibalized a bunch of other things that I gave at the next slide. There you go. We had a conference for Is Genesis History. How many people went to see the movie? Okay, good. If you haven't, I recommend it. We're going to be showing it tomorrow. We'll be showing little pieces of it tomorrow. It's like a 100-minute movie, something like that. So we're going to have to show parts of it. We won't be able to show all of it. So anyway, we had a conference. No, right there. We had a conference, a follow-up conference in near Nashville, Tennessee, in Dixon, Tennessee, in which we invited students, and actually it was free tuition for students to come for the week, and educators to come to this conference where those who, the scientists and scholars who had been in the movie, were we were given the opportunity to go into depth into our different subjects. And so we had biologists, geologists, and astronomers. There was an archaeologist there. We were paired together, archaeology and Hebrew, and I'm a Hebraist. So we gave about the count is now about over 70 lectures, about 50-minute lectures apiece. And then there were nine of us that also gave a little devotional, Why I Am a Creationist. And they were really interesting. I knew all the guys were creationists, but I didn't know their background. And it was so all that stuff is available. If you're on Facebook, you can just go to Is Genesis History. You can see at the bottom. I don't know whether he can zoom this. Can you zoom that right there? No, don't go to the next page. I think you can zoom. There you go. Good. There's the website, isgenesishistory.com. And if you just click on the Facebook icon, then you can, a lot of the stuff was archived. And we actually did live stream on Facebook. The cameras allowed that, and editing and so forth. So I thought that was that was amazing. So two of my lectures were live streamed. You look at the numbers of how many people have looked and streamed it. They're pretty good numbers. Some of them are really big, for Dr. Snelling and Andy and Dr. Faulkner. They're like 27,000. But I got like 5,000 or something like that. Anyway, but isgenesishistory.com, and you click on the Facebook icon. Everybody's lectures are there. The two that were archived. And then you can, and this is no commercial or anything, but you can download all of them, all 70 or however many it is, from Is Genesis History. I think it's for 70 lectures. You think that's a lot of, that's like 3,500 minutes of lecture for just $10. So anyway, that's what's available. So The movie, with the whole idea of the movie, was to have a very positive presentation of creation. There's a lot of attacks on evolution, but Thomas Purefoy, he was the director, and he was the writer, director, and producer of the film. He's an extraordinary young man. Well, I guess he's, 40, 50, I don't know, but he is, he was the driving force behind it, and he got Del Tackett, who I had never heard of Del Tackett, because I didn't really follow Focus on the Family that much, but he's well known in the Focus Family community, and he did something called the Truth Project. And so he was the one who was the common thread through the movie. He interviewed all of us, and we were interviewed on location. So the location I was interviewed at, it wasn't as spectacular as when Steve Austin was interviewed at the Grand Canyon, But I was interviewed at Hebrew Union College, where I got my doctorate, in the rare book room. We went through these manuscripts. I went through these manuscripts with Dell, and was explaining to him the significance of these different texts. So that was a wonderful experience. And I think 215,000 people have seen the movie. And the night that it was premiered on February 23rd, it was the number one movie in the country. We actually beat out the Lego movie. So, yeah, and I think we beat him out by $3,000 or something like that. But it was a phenomenon, because all the movie theaters were all packed. They had to open up new theaters and so forth. It was quite, people were turned away. And they said, you have to go to movie theater, you know, like down in Burbank, speaking from L.A. perspective. And they had to go from Valencia down to Burbank, and then they had to move up, they had to open up more theaters. And it was so successful, they decided, we're going to have two more nights. And so that was also one March 2nd and March 7th. And then Canada wanted it. And so it was opened for, I think, just one night in Canada at Selective Theaters. And now there's efforts to translate, ongoing efforts to translate the film into Japanese, Chinese, French, German, I don't know what a bunch of other languages, for those who, so we can get that positive message about creation out there. Okay, next slide. So the whole idea was, my perspective was, how do we know Genesis is history? How do we know that Genesis is history? And in an effort to correctly understand, I'm going to come down off of here so I can, it's on craning my neck, you can hear me anyway. So in an effort to correctly understand the text, and in some cases to accommodate evolutionary paradigm, and people will do this, the biblical text has been subjected to varied approaches, and I wanted to go over that with you. I thought these were some of the highlights of my talks. Next. Okay, I can't see that, but I will come a little closer. Now I can. Okay, good. Zooming out, zoom back. Okay, so you can see the three circles. These are the three basic ways in which Genesis 1 through 11, not just the creation account, but also the fall, and also the flood account, and the Tower of Babel has been looked at. Okay, so here we are up here. Okay, young Earth creationists at Eagle Fern Camp, obviously. But they're old Earth creationists, and they're believers, okay? And I'll explain what's going on there. And then we have materialistic naturalism over here. These are the three basic approaches. And I developed this in response to one of the scientists, Paul Nelson, who is in the film, works for the Discovery Institute, and he talked about having two different ways of looking at it. I thought more, there actually are three, but the idea of the two different ways is, do you believe it's history, or do you not believe it's history? Okay, that's the dichotomy that was explored in the film. Is Genesis talking about real historical events or not? Okay, however, there are really three different camps, okay? The young Earth creationists, of course, we believe it's history. We believe it's literal, we believe it's a historical narrative. It's a historical account of creation, and of the fall, and of the flood, and the Tower of Babel. We believe that with all of Genesis and all the Bible, that the narratives are historical narratives. Okay, now I'm going to go over here for a second to materialistic naturalism. You say, well, why would you go over there? Because obviously they don't believe that it is history. Nevertheless, these are biblical scholars, and they believe that, I should say they believe, they assert that the writer, they probably wouldn't say it's Moses, but that the writer of these accounts believed that he was writing real history, okay? And he presents it that way. And then this group would say, but of course he was wrong, Okay, that's what they would say. Okay, they would assert, they would affirm that the account is a narrative. It's a prose narrative. It is meant to be read as historical. The author presents it that way. So, zoom back. So, the young earth creationist and materialistic naturalist, we actually have something in common. And that is that we both understand that the account, that the author of the account, Moses, that he presents the material as historical and believes it to be historical. Okay? Now, as I said, these guys don't think that Moses was correct. It thought he was erroneous in that. But both believe it's a prose narrative that is presented historically. Okay. So then we have over here the old earth creationists. Now the old earth creationists are believers. Okay? However, they do not think it is historical. They think it's some kind of... Go back to the other one. Okay, thank you. They think it's some kind of a mythical presentation as poetic. Now, because they don't believe that it represents what actually happened, all right, then they have to have a history to attach it to. And what they attach it to is the history of these guys. Okay? So they share, these two share the idea of deep time, of evolutionary ideas. Although they're believers, they say we need to look at the text as a poetry, as mythical poetry, rather than as a prose historical narrative. So those are the three groups. Now, all the camps would agree that scientific investigation has value. And I was the only, I guess, both I and Doug Petrovich, we were biblical scholars. I mean, he is an archaeologist, and I'm a Hebraist. The rest of the guys were scientists. And sometimes they would call us scientists, and sometimes they wouldn't, but it doesn't make any difference. The point is that we all agree that scientific investigation has value. So there's a value in looking at the rocks and looking at DNA and all this stuff. We had a DNA that was a specialist, Joe DeWeese, that helped to organize the conference in Tennessee. He's a professor and a researcher at Lipscomb University. His specialty is working with DNA and in cancer detection and so forth. So these guys are really top in their field. So recognize that science does have value. So these are the three groups, young earth creationists, old earth creationists, materialists, and naturalism. Next slide. So the question is, what kind of text is Genesis 1 through 11? I think there's another part more of that. Now, is it a creation narrative written in prose, which is an erroneous archaic account? That's the red circle, okay? A creation myth written in poetry, which may interpret it with great latitude. This is the old earth position, all right? And a creation narrative written in prose, which is historically accurate. So which of these is it, and can we establish it scientifically? Can we actually prove that it's one of these three? Of course, I'm going to prove that it's this one. It's a creation narrative written in prose, which is historically accurate. Next slide. So how do we know what texts mean? This is just you put the whole thing up, the whole slide. Okay, good. Now what we have here are the four elements that are involved in reading any text, not just a Bible text, but any text. But, so let's look at it this way. Moses, okay, and it's a dual authorship of Moses and the Holy Spirit. So the author looks at an event, and then he considers his readers in order to write his text. It's not just the author looking at the event and not considering his readers. Let me just give you a quick illustration of that. What if Moses had said, if he didn't consider his readers and thought to himself, you know, I think that Swahili is a really interesting language, and I'm going to write Genesis in Swahili. What would have happened? Well, his readers wouldn't have been able to read it. They don't know Swahili, okay? And I only know a few phrases in it. But the point is that he has to consider his readers when he's writing. And so that's why we have to look at a text and what were the readers like? Of course, we are readers, but what were the original readers like? We have to consider that, and I don't have time to go into all of that right now. But just think about it. His readers had just come out, or they had been slaves in Egypt. They knew Egyptian. As a matter of fact, it may have been they were speaking in Egyptian, probably were, and Egyptian and Hebrew. But you got to consider that. When did Moses give these books to the Israelites? When did he give it to them? Well, he gave it to them just before they're going in to conquer the promised land. Matter of fact, that was part of the purpose, is to show the greatness of God compared to the Canaanite gods, that Israel will be victorious. So you have to consider the readers in order to understand a text. And this is a basic thing, author looking at the event and the readers. Now, it's only the position understanding that this is a historical narrative, okay, a historical account, that actually gives us access to the events. I have a bunch of slides in the other presentations showing, putting a line across and saying the only one of the three approaches that gives us access to what really happened is our approach, okay? Young Earth creationists. That's the only one that gives it, because the old Earth says, well, that, those events that are recorded in Genesis, that's not the way it happened. It happened according to evolution. And of course, the materialist rationalists, they would say it happened according to evolution. So neither one of those has access to the event, but young Earth creationists actually have access to the event. We know what happened. We believe it's what the text says happened. Next slide. Now, in terms of understanding what kind of text this is, we can actually look at a text and tell what kind of text it is. There's a big word, it's called genre. Not that big of a word. It's a French word, it's a French term, and it means what kind of text is this? And the community knows. So you know what kind of text it is. So when you're reading a Marvel comic book, you know what kind of text it is. You know, the Man of Steel or whatever, he's jumping over buildings and all that kind of stuff. You know that's not real. You can tell that. Well, the same thing is true with literary texts. I don't consider Marvel Comics a literary text, if you look at different things, these different aspects of the text, you can tell whether it's prose or poetry, whether the language is basically unadorned or it's elevated. It's really fancy language. That's what poetry has. Whether it uses words and phrases in a typical way, or it has a lot of atypicality, a lot of unusual things. Does it have a lot of imagery in it? If it's absent, well, it's probably on this side here. And if it's present, then it's going to be on this side. Figures of speech, absent, it will be historical theology, historical prose narrative. On this side, it will be poetic. Subject matter, historical. Okay, it really happened. Here, it's myth. And here we have, basically, on this side, the historical theological is no suspense. On this side is suspense. The character is Yahweh. Here, you have ancient Near Eastern deities. Next slide. These are just, this is just the difference between what happens in Genesis, and this is a actual text from Atrahasis. And we have these, it's in Akkadian poetry, and we have this wild story. And if you go to the next slide, Next slide. Okay. No, I'm sorry. Previous slide. Okay. Notice that the creator goddess says, it is not possible for me to make things. What kind of creator goddess is that? She can't even make anything, she says. And so this is the poetry. This is the Atrahasis epic. This is from Lambert and Mallard. Just to give you an idea, I know we're doing this quickly, but just to give you an idea how different the ancient Near Eastern so-called creation and flood texts are from the account in Genesis, which is a very straightforward narrative. Next slide. Okay, there's also a way you can tell the difference between these, and that is I did a statistical study of verb distribution, of the types of verbs that occur in narrative versus poetry. That's a whole presentation in itself. But I worked with two statisticians to make sure, they made sure that I dotted every I and crossed every T, and they were exacting, believe me. And we came up with this curve, I should say, they did. This was based upon a random sample that was then mathematically extended to all possible samples of, it was 49 poetic texts and 48 narrative texts. And it produces this curve, okay? These are the actual texts that were in the random, called a stratified random sample. These were the narrative texts. This is Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3, way up here. So this is the band of all the possible curves from the model of modeling just one type of verb, and that is the main narrative verb in Hebrew, which is called the viactol. And what percentage of all the verbs in a particular passage were viactols? And the larger that percentage, the further you are out here on the curve, and also then the probability that it is a narrative. So this is a very important slide. If you're on this side, you're classified as poetry. On this side, it's classified as narrative. And that was kind of the results of a study of a number of years. Next slide. Oh, this is, I didn't know this was in here. Okay. This is the population. The logistic band shows 99.5% confidence interval for the probability of the text is narrative. So, if for Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3, I'm just looking at that, then the probability that's a narrative based upon this statistical study is between 0.999942 and 0.999987. That is the probability that it is a narrative. So, basically, this is one. Okay? Probability and statistics, there are no zeros and ones, but in real life, there are zeros and ones, right? There are zeros and ones. You can't take a truck that's 12 feet high and go under an 11-foot-7-inch bridge, right? If it's got 11-foot-7-inch clearance, or 11-foot-8, I'm sorry, 11-foot-8. There's actual bridge in North Carolina, which these drivers try to get underneath this bridge. It says 11-foot-8. And the owners of the bridge set up cameras, and they said, this is crazy. Why are they doing this? This is 11-foot-8, and they continually try to take their 12-foot, 13-foot, whether it's an 18-wheeler or it's a big RV, they try to drive underneath it, and the sound of the air conditioner is being scraped off the top of an RV when they hit that thing, okay? So there are such things as zeros and ones in real life, okay? So what this is a one, all right? Next slide. Now, that means it's statistically indefensible to argue that this text is poetry based upon this, based upon the percentage of this type of verb. And this is an actual proof then, a mathematical statistical proof that this account is a narrative. Next slide. Now, since the text is a narrative, what does that imply? Did the authors of Hebrew narratives believe that they were writing about real events? Well, yes, they did. Next slide. Put all 15 of them up. There are 15 proofs that the authors believe they're writing real history and presented it that way. And you can read about all of these in my books and articles and so forth. With the Rape Project, that's what I did that with, and it's also in Coming to Grips with Genesis. I have an article in there, and there's stuff also on the in the Answers Research Journal journal on the Answers in Genesis website. But these are just things when you just think about the way the Old Testament is. It's obvious that God's people are defined in terms of their past. They're always talking about the past. They're always talking about that they're commanded to keep the memory of the past alive. They're told, teach your children what has happened here. Okay? These things, remembers the past devolves on the present and determines the future. There's retrospection. They say, well, we did it that way in the past and we ended up with being involved in judgment, so we don't want to do it that way again. Okay? And so they learn from the past. They reflect on the past. They explain customs, like in the book of Ruth. Why did that man take the sandal off his feet and hand it to Boaz and say, oh, no, I can't marry Ruth? That's explained. Okay, ancient names and current sayings are traced back to their origins. All these things are done. These are all evidence that we have a historical text here. Let me just jump down here. Oh, monuments and pronouncements are a sign of concrete reason as well as thought in history. The idea here is monuments are set up. Joshua set up monuments, right? He set up a monument in the Jordan River, right? He set up 12 stones and also on the side of the Jordan. So, and he says, now you tell your children in the future what those stones mean. That means that those stones mean that the river was open. And Israel went across on dry land. That's what that means. There are historical footnotes sprinkled throughout the text. Moses will inject these interesting details showing that he's very much a historian. Things like there was never a storm like this before in the history of Egypt. Well, how does he know that? Well, because he has access to the Egyptian records, and he can say things like that. We have historical footnotes. There are places in the Book of Chronicles where it says these records are ancient. Well, that's a footnote. Okay, these are the kinds of things that a scholar would use in his writing. So we have the historical footnotes, written records used as sources or cited. We're told this comes from the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah. We're told this comes from the prophecies of Iddo. Various different things. This comes from the book of Yasher, okay, which either means of the upright ones, or it might mean a chronicle. So these records are cited. There's precise chronological reference points are supplied. In the flood, I've been studying the flood narrative since 2006. Now, that's just crazy. I mean, that's 11 years I've been doing this, okay? 11 years studying that. But there are 5 fixed dates given. Beginning of the flood, when the ark came to rest, when the mountaintops appeared, when Noah took the top off the ark, and when it was finally dry. Those are 5 fixed dates. They're given in terms of the year and the life of Noah, the month of the year, and it may not actually be his year, but the years at that time, and then also the day. So, it's 600-217. That's when the flood began. And it ended 601-227. We have exact dates given. Precise chronological reference points are supplied. The genealogies, the book of Genesis is built on genealogies. Observations of cultic days and seasons are called acts of commemoration. That has to do with Passover and Pentecost and tabernacles. Prophetic utterances are recalled and related events in the narrative. That's which had more time. But Josiah, one example, Josiah is involved in a reform effort and he's destroying all of the pagan altars that have been built throughout Israel. He comes across this grave. And he says, whose grave is that? And we're going to take their bones out and burn them on the altar. You know, and they said, no, don't do that, Josiah. That's where the prophet is buried who said 300 years ago that you're going to do what you're doing right now. Okay? And actually in the text, in 2 Kings, it says that. So it's all tied together. This prophetic utterance are recalled and related to events in the narrative. And this is the one I think that's the most interesting time words. Challenge ancient readers to validate historical claims made in the text. Well, what I'm talking about here is we find, particularly in the book of Joshua, the statement, Ad Hayom Hazeh, until this day. And so Joshua will be talking and he'll say, this is what we did to Achan. What happened to Achan? We burned him and his family because of the sin he committed and taking the forbidden things from Jericho. Remember, he took money and he took a garment and he took a wedge of gold. He and his family were stoned and burned, and then they piled the rocks on top of them. And years later, Joshua was saying, okay, you can, if you go to that place, in the Valley of Achor, if you dig through those rocks and get to the bottom, you're going to find those skeletons there. They're there until this day. Now, wouldn't a author be, basically a fool if he were to challenge his readers? Check out what I'm saying. I'm speaking the truth. This is real. These are facts. And you can validate it yourself. I mean, he's basically saying, I dare you. I double dare you. Okay? Go ahead. Check it if you want. And you'll see it. And this is the kind of things that proves that what we have is real, real history. And this last one is very interesting, too. The historical trajectories link different portions of the text and widely separate periods. Just mentioning one person, one figure who appears in the book of Numbers, a sorcerer by the name of Balaam. Okay? Don't be fooled by Balaam. He's slick. He opposes God. Remember, he's the one, his donkey, his she-donkey has to speak to him and say, why are you beating me? And he's supposed to be this real, brilliant prophet and sorcerer and doesn't realize it's his donkey talking to him and he starts talking with his donkey. Okay? And she's smarter than he is, really. But Balaam, then he appears in different points, and he's all the way through until the book of Revelation. And he's treated as a historical figure all the way through. And so we have these historical trajectories. These are 15 proofs that the biblical authors believe they were writing real history. Okay, they're writing real history, it's presented that way. Next slide, please. Now, this is a quote by Meir Sternberg. He's a Jewish literary scholar and biblical scholar. But he takes these ideas of the historical to a higher level and says it more eloquently than any evangelical I've read. He says, as seekers for the truth, professional or amateur, we can take or leave the truth claim of inspiration. Then as readers, we must simply take it. He's saying, I know you evangelicals that you believe in inspiration, that this is an inspired text. And he also says, I've shown you that the author believed he's writing real history and presents it that way. A lot of these ideas come from Sternberg. And he says, as readers, we must simply take it. If you believe in inspiration, just like any other biblical premise or convention, from the existence of God to the sense borne by specific words, or else invent our own text. You have to invent your own text if you say, this is not historical. That's what Sternberg is saying. And as believers in inspiration, of course, then we say, of course, that is what it has to be. But the old earth guys say, well, it doesn't have to be. Next slide. Just bring them all in there. Yeah. So this is what a text is. It's a literary portrayal of historical events which communicates a theological message. Every single narrative in the Bible, not just the Old Testament, is a literary portrayal of historical events which communicates a theological message. These three things... No, leave that slide up there. Okay, thank you. These three things, literary, historical, and theological, they are not mutually exclusive. That's a false dichotomy. There are six false dichotomies. So literary, it's historical events. Next slide. And so we have these three things. Every text, narrative text, is a historical account. It's real events. Okay, real events. Then it's a literary portrayal. There is a literary aspect of the text. Moses was a brilliant writer, and he presents, like as I said, with the flood narrative, he has a brilliant presentation of how the flood unfolded, and he does it in a series of progressive parallel panels, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. And then a theological message. And the theological message comes across most clearly when you understand how the literary portrayal of these historical events. So we have to consider all three things. Next slide, please. Now, if it's a historical account, we have an advantage over those who are don't believe it's historical, because what we... Since we're taking it as real history, then we take what is in the text seriously, okay? And because of that, my team was able to determine that the sequence of verbs is such that sometimes things are out of sequence. And yet Hebrew grammar has been saying for years and years and years this particular verb form, the vayiktol, indicates sequence. Well, we have many examples where it doesn't indicate sequence. And I discovered this in studying the flood, that there are a number of processes that occur on the 150th day. That they're all long processes. They couldn't have occurred in sequence, let alone on one day. And so we have to understand that this particular verb type has a different meaning than we thought. And we have to process that. And it turns out that it's not just me and my team, but great Hebraists around the world are starting to realize this. Jan Houston and John Cook, this name is probably don't mean anything to you, but nevertheless, they've written books about this. How about the meaning of the word that's translated flood? Now, most people would say, well, the flood, that means the 365 day, if it's a lunar calendar, 365 days of the water is on the earth, right? That would be the flood. However, if you take it literally, like a historical account, that there can't be any contradictions, right? Can't be any contradictions. So in Genesis 9, 28, 29, it says 350 years after the flood. That's when Noah died, right? If you look at the account of the flood itself, when did the flood end? It ended on his 601st year, right? A 601st year. Well, you add 350 to that, you would get what? 601 plus 350 is what? 951. Well, it tells us in Genesis 9:29 that Moses was 950 when he died. 350 years after the flood. Well, what's the answer? Flood doesn't mean the whole 365 days. It means the first 40 days when the water is rising to a peak at the end of that 40-day period. Can you give me the one showing this one right here? This is the profile of the flood. 40 days. And then this is the period of it's called the transgression. That's what geologists call it, okay? Transgression. The same term. Okay, now it's a little PowerPoint, so you can see it run. Can you run the PowerPoint? Get that? Well, it's going to do it now. Okay, so then you see the, and it's, this is all too small for you to see, but this is the deluge timeline. And it goes up to for 40 days, and then a gradual thing on. Okay, next, go back to the other part. Okay, so the meaning of the word flood, that's the Hebrew word mabul, is the 40 days. It can't be the 365. That would cause a contradiction. Then this is really interesting here, the temporal constraints. And I thought, I know we're almost out of time. I thought that there was an issue. I thought when I looked at the Noah and the birds, what could, what would that have to do with the chronology? When I started studying and I said, wow, there actually is something here. Because we're told about what the earth was like during the flight of those birds, particularly of the dove. It says on its first flight that there was water over all the surface of all the earth. Now that sounds like the water over all the earth, right? There's no land appearing. And yet we know that the water, we know that the land began to appear on about the 218th day or something like that. We can work with that in order to establish some temporal constraints, because we're taking this seriously. We're taking it seriously that's talking about real events. And then this is also really interesting that the geologists want to know what the text is saying. And the way the flood is described as coming in, as the water is increasing, it's lifting up the ark. It's getting powerful. It's getting more and more water. Then it becomes very, very powerful. It turns out that there are, in the geological formations in the Southwest and all over the earth, actually, there are these large sequences of rocks that seem to coordinate with the description in Genesis. And so we're taking it literally, historical account. Next slide. It's a literary portrayal. When you look at the flood narrative, you got to realize there's narrative, and then there's speech, God's speech, and God's speech tends to be poetic. And then there's also deliberate duplications. Now, liberals say this is clumsy, conflation, and mistakes, and what actually, it's very deliberate, okay? And we get these progressive parallel panels. Give me the other one that shows that and zoom in on it. These themes are developed through this means. It starts with the domination of the evil of mankind, Yahweh's recognition of that, his observation, his disapproval, his reaction, and then his proclamation of this of obliteration. And these things are repeated. And this repetition, this progressive nature of these parallel panels are coming literally in the text, like the waves of water that are coming upon the earth. And so this is very deliberate the way this is done. Now, go back to the other one, and we'll finish up. Next slide. Now, the theological message, there's a lot of connection to creation. Let me just mention a couple of these things. Okay, after the flood, the Lord repeats the creation mandate. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. That's what he said to Adam and Eve and to the animals when he created them. So we have a lot of connections between the flood and creation. One more, and that is when the mountaintops appeared. Now, I don't know what you are thinking about here, but the idea of the mountaintops appearing, in the Hebrew, it's exactly the same word that's used, the same verb, for the mountaintops appearing as when the dry land appeared at creation. Genesis 1:9, let the waters which are under heaven gather together in one place in order that the dry land might appear. And then what we have in Genesis 8:5 is the mountaintops appeared, okay? The same language. And what it shows us is that the flood is it's the great flood of Noah is the great uncreation of the world. And then there is the great recreation of the world as the waters recede and after the flood. So it is an uncreation creation cycle. And the theology of there, these various different connections to creation and the fall are very evident. Well, I wish we had more time, but I just wanted to give you an idea of this, what we're doing now. Now, tomorrow we're going to show portions of the movie Is Genesis History, if you haven't seen it. And I probably won't make any comments on it. It's self-explanatory. I don't think it could be improved, actually. But that's it. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this time we've had to quickly look at these things and to realize how majestic and powerful the text of your word is, and how we can believe in it, that it's historical. It is brilliantly written literarily in order to communicate powerful theological truth. We thank you for this time, and we pray, Lord, that the efforts of our team, of Genesis History team, will be fruitful and will bring honor to you as we elucidate these early chapters of the Bible. May you receive all the honor and glory, we pray, in Christ's name. Amen.